Welcome and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in a listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star one on your phone at any time to be placed into the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment brief. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Odette Madrigo. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. I'm very sorry I was not able to join you last week. To tell you, it was my grandson's eighth grade graduation that I couldn't miss, and so I really thank Corey and all the rest of you for filling in for me. And quite frankly, even if I hadn't been there, I'm not sure how helpful I would have been, as I had some surgery and I was a little out of it part of the week last week. So I'm very glad to be back and reconnected with all of you. And it does sound like you had a very lively and productive conversation last week, and we've had some discussions in between, gotten some middles from some subcommittee members. And yesterday, Jeff Wong and Corey and I had a very good dialogue about the alternatives assessment process, both as it's spelled out in the statute, which is the topic for this subcommittee, and the possibility of tiered variations of the alternatives assessment processes. So Corey will be going over some of our discussions a little bit, as well as going over the case study that has been prepared following your discussion last week, showing how asking the questions that are in the topic paper as it applies to window cleaner. So I thank you all for joining us, and I want to thank you in advance for your homework that I'm sure we will be seeing soon and discussing today. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to your chair, Ken.
Thank you, Odette, and thank you, folks, for getting on the call here. Should I do the roll call, or, Kathy, are you going to do that?
I'll go ahead and do it, Ken, if that's all right.
If you don't mind doing a roll call now, that would be useful.
No problem. Okay, hi, everybody. This is Kathy Barwick. I'm staff, BTSC staff and staff to the Green Ribbon Science Panel, and I'm going to do a brief roll call of Science Panel members so that we all know who's on the line. So please respond when I call your name. Ken Geiser.
Here.
Art Fong.
Here.
Roger McFadden.
Here.
Julia Quint.
Here.
George Daston.
Here.
Tim Malloy. Hopefully Tim will be joining us soon. I understand Ann Blake had an emergency, so she won't be here. Hope everything's okay. Mike Wilson, I know, is going to be arriving around 10 o'clock for our call, and Julie Zimmerman. So,
I'm here. Delia Ogunshayton is here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Present. Call myself in.
Awesome.
Great, Delia.
Hi,
how are you? I want to remind people that this meeting is recorded, and we'll be posting the sound file later this afternoon, and that's our commemoration of the discussion. And for members of the public, if you want to make comment, you're going to press star one on your phone to get in the queue, and it'll go smoothly if you don't need to wait until the public comment period to do that. So you can do that any time prior to the public comment period. So. And I want to let the GRASS members, the subcommittee members, that you can mute your lines by pressing star six. And I believe that's all I need to say. So, and I did send out additional materials. There was a flow chart that was sent out yesterday afternoon. For members of the public, if you want to see all the complete materials, just go to the subcommittee website. And that's where we have posted all of these background materials. And I will turn it over to Ken.
Excuse me, Tim Malloy has joined.
Oh, great.
Hi, Tim, great. Thank you. So, yes, we have another day, another morning in your part of the country to engage this topic that is the first of the three questions that were posed to the panel. Our subcommittee is dealing with the alternatives assessment as written in the actual statute. Please remember that our comments are going to provide the basis for the report that will be presented at the July 14th, 15th meeting in Sacramento. Also, just quickly remember that this is a public meeting, so members of the public are listening in, and other members of the panel may be listening in as well. Secondly, that we are presenting our ideas not as a consensus statement. Indeed, we don't really have to agree with each other or even push other people to understand our comments. We're making our comments as individuals, and each comment is respected in that terms. I'm going to ask shortly Corey and Odette to go through the actual questions themselves. My plan for the meeting is really to try to go through all of the five questions that we've been presented as we did at our last phone call. And we will just go through them hopefully in more depth than we did before. The staff at the DTSC has made an attempt to try to make the questions a bit more concrete by focusing them on a formulated product so that we can have something in mind as we're speaking, and I encourage people to try to keep window cleaner or some other formulated product, but it seemed to be a reasonable one, in mind as you make the comments, and it'll help, I think, to kind of do what we were trying to do at the last meeting, and I think it successfully did toward the end in particular, is get more specific and clear in our comments. I thought that the last time we met, our phone conversation was very useful. We heard it was important to retain flexibility. We heard Tim's very nice rendition of some principles: transparency, rigorousness, consistency, and proportionality. We talked about steps. We also discussed the necessity of chemicals as being a part of this, that there needs to be some kind of screening of alternatives and a wide range of consideration of alternatives. We ended up speaking quite a bit about tools. We talked about performance standards versus some kind of specified tools themselves. And I think that generally we had a lot of specific things that we offered in the way of our particular comments, and I'm hoping we can continue that. We will go for the 2.5 hours. We're a ways into it now. We will try to take a break in about a little over an hour and 15 minutes or so, but we will try to finish up by what must be about 12 o'clock your time and 3 o'clock our time. Please remember to try to keep your comments brief and state your name when you make them so that we can try to keep a rolling discussion going. And it's always useful to try to clarify differences that you might have with others and in so doing your comments. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Corey and Odette to kind of walk us through the five questions. You should have gotten these new questions with their more detailed descriptions. You should have an interesting table from Tim on the assessment criteria, and you should have this recent diagram that was sent out yesterday. So, Corey, do you want to take it from here?
So Ken, I was so flustered by forgetting Dele in the roll call that I subsequently forgot to go around the room with the roll call here in Sacramento.
So oh, you're right.
We're going to do that first. So, Corey, you want to start?
Corey, yes.
Odette Madriago.
Radhika Majel.
Kathy Barwick. And we have Tom Jacobs here as a guest.
Public, I'm sorry.
Member of the public.
Kelly Fitzpatrick.
Alan Hirsch, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment.
Delia Rodriguez.
Colleen Heck.
Hortensia Mimi.
And now we'll turn it over to Corey. Thank you.
Okay, so what we did with the case studies, basically take your topic questions and just kind of tweak it a bit to be a bit more specific to a formulated product. So if you go through the case study, I think you will drill down into seeing how what your ideas from the first call actually, how they would be applied to an actual formulated product. So keep that in mind. So do you think we need to go through the questions in depth, or should we just go on to see how they fit into the flow?
Well, I think we should maybe hold the flow chart till a little bit later on. I would suggest we go through these questions. But, Ken, did you want to go through these one by one with us kind of presenting on a specific question? And I guess we should go through the whole thing because it's before the public comment period.
Yeah, I think we do need to sort of just stay within our public comment law.
So
you should walk your say. You don't have to, obviously, the committee has read or the panel has read these. You just want to, I think, hit what you think are the high points of these, of what you're trying to get.
So, as I mentioned, we did have a great discussion. You mentioned as we had a great discussion about the ideas and input from the first topic paper questions, and now in drilling down, we'll see how they actually work on a formulated product. So, question 1A is a restatement of your first for your first topic questions. Is what basic requirements NAA for a window cleaner would contain that would meet the requirements of the Health and Safety Code 25253. That is, what basic requirements should be should a compliant AA contain and should be set out in regulations. Specifically, at a minimum, what should the AA for a window cleaner contain?
Corey, I might suggest you not read it as much as just hit what do you think is the real thing of each one.
I think we're looking for specifically what minimum requirements in the AA should a window cleaner formulated product have, and then what are the basic requirements that would meet the life cycle requirements for that window cleaner. Should life cycle thinking, inventories, or a full-blown life cycle analysis be done for all 13 factors, those A through M factors? Specifically, if you had three alternatives, such as glacial acetic acid in water, and ammonia in water, how would you go about evaluating those three alternatives in light of the 13 factors, and how would you actually choose which one to be your safer alternative?
Mm-hmm.
And then 1C, how should that window cleaner group those 13 elements? This is another way of looking at how to conduct an LCA, whether it's thinking, qualitative, or quantitative. If you can group some of the 13 factors together to be more efficient, and taking into consideration Tim's thinking about proportionality and following up with question B, kind of going further with Tim's suggestions on transparency, rigorosity, and consistency, what kind of information to support the AA analysis for window cleaner. And something that we didn't touch upon last week was a reasonable time frame for completing a AA evaluation. And if you have other ideas related to a formulated product, and if we have time, how would that differ for assembled products?
And this is Odette, and I'll just chime in here, and without going through the details of the chart, though hopefully you've had a chance to look at it, this comes out of the conversation that Jeff and Corey and I had yesterday. And, you know, we sat down with the questions that came out from your call as well as the call that Subcommittee 2 had last week on tiered alternatives assessments, and really looked closely at the statute and the wording of the statute. And we came up with some kind of, you know, basic conclusions or basic questions. And one of those basic questions that we think we're going to need to hone in on is what constitutes a life cycle assessment tool? What is its goal? Is it a mathematical model, or could it be something simpler? And we think that at least in the confines of the statute, it could be something much less rigorous than a full-blown mathematical model. And in many cases, I think that there are not mathematical models available, and so we would want to use something less rigorous. And one of the things that supports this is that the statute urges DTSC to make sure that there are tools that are available that are easy to use, including easy to use by the consumer to make purchasing requirements. So that makes us think that we are not bound to have very complex mathematical models. So this is something, given that we think we have this flexibility, that we would like some advice on. And again, I think you've already discussed this, and I know the other subcommittee is discussing this, is as we're using the 13 factors, some of them might be used initially as a screening factor, and you go down into more of a qualitative assessment, and finally the most rigorous would be a quantitative. Maybe you reserve quantitative for those things are of highest concern or where you need more in-depth analysis. Anyway, we wanted to share this with you because we think there is the flexibility there, and hopefully that will help you with your discussion and your advice to the department. So, Ken, is there anything else that you would like Corey or I to touch on before we go on to the public comment?
I think that's fine. We'll take clarification from the panel members if there is clarification after the public comment period, but I think that's fine for the at least giving us a clear idea on the agenda. With that, I would then turn this over back over to the operator and ask that we take some time for public comment and ask the operator, are there people who have indicated that they would like to make public comment to the panel?
We currently have one participant in the queue.
Can we ask that that person be fairly short, but please put that person on.
Our first public comment comes from Gibbous Bald. Sir, your line is open.
Okay, thank you. This is
Please
Davis
state
Bald.
Your name again.
Uh-huh, Davis Bald, and I work with Commonweal here in California as well as the Change Coalition, Californians for a Healthy and Green Economy. We've been following these regulations closely, as you know. So I have two things to say. First is sort of on a more general level, very pleased to see the Green Ribbon Science Panel being used to a greater degree based on feedback and being used strategically. I think that the work of these subcommittees is going to, you know, form in many ways the foundation for the next draft of the regulations. And given that resources are scarce at DTSC, that is all to the good. So it's a smart decision also to be using the Green Ribbon Science Panel. And so with this sort of fresh infusion of energy into both the process and new director coming in, I'm just hopeful that we will see some relatively quick movement on the development of these regs so we can get it all off our plates. I'm sure we're all ready to move on to other activities, but also realizing that DTSC has a large and important agenda besides AB 1879. And so recognizing that moving quickly will be in everyone's interest. And then on more content level, and this kind of would apply across alternatives assessment and other parts of the regulation to be written, is that I think a key thing, as has been said by many others, that we want to get at the end of the day is more information about chemicals. And so to the degree that wherever we're working on alternatives assessment or prioritization, let's write in some requirements that more information has to come forward, and that can then drive additional conversations. But to, if there's any phasing in of this program, I would really change would love to see the requirement for information to be made public about chemicals come to the fore, and that there be some incentives and sticks for not providing, you know, reward entities that come forward with the information if something can be structured appropriately, but have some penalties if there's foot dragging. So thanks for listening to these comments.
Thank you. Operator, is there any other member of the public that would like to speak?
I show no further comments at this time.
And may I check at any of the remote locations? Anyone want to take an opportunity to speak as a member of the public?
Not in Sacramento.
All right.
Not in Berkeley.
Okay. It sounds like we have heard, we have provided the appropriate time for the public. We've had one comment, and I believe, operator, that will close up the public comment period. Okay. With that, we would move forward. We have about, why don't we take a little over an hour to get us up to a break. And try to, one is kind of reflect on your thoughts that you might have gelled since over the last week. Obviously, the department has put forward some new, a new, more detailed set of questions here, and this diagram. Are there any clarifying questions or issues that you would like to address with the with the department itself before we get into the actual discussion?
Ken, this is Art. May I ask Odette a question, please?
Sure.
Odette, you mentioned in context of your LCA introduction and discussion something about the consumer, and I guess I missed that. Were you suggesting that a tool should be simple enough that the consumer can use it? I was a little confused on that particular aspect. If you wouldn't mind clarifying that for me, that would be great. Thank you.
I'd be happy to. The statute that, you know, requires the department to adopt the alternatives assessment regulations also includes a provision that the department shall, that in adopting these regulations, the department shall ensure that the tools available are in a form that allows for ease of use and transparency of application. And then it goes on to say the department shall also make every feasible effort to devise simplified, accessible tools that manufacturers, distributors, retailers, and consumers can use to make consumer product manufacturing, sales, and purchase decisions. And if you wanted to look at this yourself, it's in Health and Safety Code Section 25253C. And this is in Attachment Attachment 1-1 that was provided, you know, before last week's meeting.
Great. Thank you very much.
Any other clarifying questions to the department? Okay. Well, my suggestion would be we sort of follow the pattern that we followed last week and sort of take up question 1A first. And then do the life cycle part second. It sort of follows a bit the actual flow of the diagram as well. And as you may remember, when we spoke last week about this first question, sort of what are the basic requirements or procedures that one should follow, that's when Tim brought up his pretty interesting principles, which I think have served very well. But we still, at this point, haven't said what we think are the basic fundamental requirements themselves. And I think it would be useful if you could, if you are thinking that there should be steps, if you're thinking that there are specific things that ought to be done with these, that ought to be a part of a window cleaner alternatives assessment, it would be very useful to lay out your vision of what that, of those basic steps or requirements should be. And particularly they're asking us, should we address the question of necessity of a chemical? Anyone want to give that a start?
Well, and this is George.
George, you were wonderful last week on this very same moment, and I thank you again. Right.
I just had the shortest fuse or something. I don't know. So, you know, thanks for getting this down into some sort of a concrete example, because I think it helps to talk about it. And, you know, in my mind, this is, you know, where the process needs to start with some sort of problem formulation step that basically identifies what the more critical aspects of the A through M criteria are for this particular for this particular product are, and you know that to me would be the first step in the process, which would be to identify using some sort of logic-based process that would be explicitly stated, you know, what you would determine would be the most important aspects of an alternative assessment. I mean, what are the characteristics of a window cleaner? And I'm assuming that we're, you know, and I peeked down at 1B. I'm assuming that we're really still looking at you know, basically aqueous-based mixtures of chemicals that would be applied to a window. And so, you know, it's everything from the comparative human health hazards to, you know, I would assume that when someone is done with the solution that is going down the drain to, you know, what happens to it in the water treatment and its persistence and all that. These are volatile compounds, although that's probably going to be a secondary consideration. But those are my examples of, you know, where you would start thinking about, you know, which issues would raise to the top and which ones you would spend the most time on. You know, and this is I think another great example, because I would assume also that there would be economic considerations for each of the choices here that could be spelled out.
George, last time when we talked, you were also a little skeptical of steps at one point. Let me say, you know, sometimes I, you know, the way we frame this is at Lowell is a set of steps that start with kind of problem identification, sort of clarification on the chemical of concern, then an analysis of the uses of the chemical, then sort of a third step is really a search for alternatives and potential pre-screening of some of those alternatives. And then a fourth step is really the actual comparison of the alternatives and the identification of whether there are alternatives based on health and environmental aspects. And then a fifth step is kind of a review of performance and cost. And then finally, the last step is sort of a recommendation. Is that, do you find that problematic, or is that, should the regulation be clear about that kind of thing, or how do you feel about that?
My own personal opinion is that I think that taking an approach like that is entirely reasonable. I think it's consistent with what I was advocating. The only concern that I have is that is in whether there is some sort of implicit weighting of the factors up front in such an analysis, and you know that's where I would grow concerned that the flexibility in the system is lost.
Okay, that's fair. Anyone else want to weigh in on this, on steps or processes? Is there a minimum that we should that the department should be specifying?
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue.
And Julia, too.
All right, Tim and then Julia. Yes? Tim.
Okay. Roger.
Okay, and Roger. Tim, Julia, Roger. Let me just check. Anyone else? Let's go with that at the moment. Tim?
Thank you. I would say I generally agree, Ken, with your discussion that there ought to be a sequence of steps. I feel slightly differently about the relationship between the steps. So let me just start out. I think that any process is going to have as a first step identifying potential alternatives and initially screening out some things that really aren't alternatives. So for that, I think you'll have to have certain kind of threshold factors that would be used for that screening process. And I would say two things about these factors. First, the factors should be focused on kind of the driving features of the statute. So for me, there should be some kind of minimum protectiveness associated with an alternative. So for I can't articulate the precise standard, but the idea behind it would be you just going to kind of screen out the obvious bad alternatives in terms of environmental protection, right? So you wouldn't, there's going to be certain alternatives you look at, and, you know, they're just so much worse in terms of human health or environmental hazards based on the data they have, and there are other alternatives that are so much better that they get screened out at this stage. And it would have to be kind of a quantum of environmental hazard that is so high that we're comfortable that no matter how well these alternatives might do on other factors like functionality or other things, they're just not acceptable as a minimum, right? So I can't articulate how you would define that standard. I'd be happy to work on that some more. But just as a kind of a simple answer, I would say the first kind of screen should be a health-based or an environmentally health-based screen. And then the other screen should be based on functionality. That is, you have to show that this alternative has at least some minimal level of functionality such that it could be a replacement. You wouldn't want this analysis here to be so involved that you're making fine choices between something, how well does it work compared to the baseline, because that, I think, needs to be looked at in the broader context of all its other features. But, again, if you've got something that is clearly just not a job, and, again, I can't articulate that, you would screen that out. This is where I get to this question of necessity, because I would like your screen for functionality here for a potential alternative would depend a little bit on just how necessary this product is. So for products that are really, really have great social value or importance, you'd probably let a little bit more pass this screen than for products where the product itself really is not viewed as having high social utility. So I would start out, the first step would be screening potential alternatives. So now maybe you've got a manageable set of alternatives to compare to your baseline window cleaner or whatever. Then I think, you know, you should have the step of data collection across the A through M, however, whatever factors you end up with as the criteria for comparison. There should be a collection of available data with respect to all of those. Here again, at this point, thinking about proportionality and tractability of the program, it seems to me this might be an appropriate point for the person performing the alternative analysis to make the case that certain criteria just aren't relevant to this kind of product and its alternatives. So my view is that the data collection and the consideration of the criteria for comparison ought to have a default that you start out including everything. If you can make a showing that window cleaner and all the alternatives for the window cleaners really just don't raise greenhouse gas issues or don't raise issues of endocrine disruption or whatever, then there wouldn't be a necessity to go out and engage in a lot of data collection for that. I don't know. I can't articulate for you right now what that standard would be. I think there's plenty of examples in other regulatory programs where this happens, where you have a set of default factors and where the person seeking the permit or the approval can make a showing that they don't really have to address that factor. So one could look at some other regulatory programs for that. Having done the data collection then, I think, and this is where I think I part ways with you, if I understood you correctly, Ken, as to what you were saying, where yours I thought was kind of like a sequential analysis where if you identify various alternatives and you compare them on the hazard, and then perhaps certain of them make it out of hazard, and then you compare them across maybe functionality or you compare them across other sets of criteria. The concern I have with, and maybe I'm getting into another question here, but the concern I have with kind of doing it stepwise like that is if you're doing that, you're not allowing trade-offs across those other criteria. So, for example, it may be that one alternative does better than another alternative in terms of how it deals with with human health. But if you screen out that second alternative, the one that didn't do quite as well as on human health, there's no opportunity for it to kind of compensate for that with respect to other factors, maybe, you know, ecological impacts or so on and so forth. So I don't have a strong feeling. Let me back up first. I think as long as everybody is aware that by choosing a sequential, you know, screening things out through different steps, that you're cutting off the ability to trade off how things do on criteria, you know, there's nothing conceptually wrong with that. That's really a value-based decision about, you know, how important one criteria is as opposed to another. It's a different kind of decision analysis. And then I think the last step would be once you've, you know, you've collected all the data and you have kind of your assessment, your matrix of all that data, then the next step would be the actual evaluation. And I think my view about that evaluation step goes into these other questions that come up later. Thanks.
Yeah, I think, Tim, your point is a good one. I'm, you're right. You probably ought to have some kind of iterative looping there such that you make some judgments. But a very good set of points. Thank you. Julia.
Yes. My approach, I guess, is a mix of a lot of what has been said, but I would start by collecting data on the priority product so I can have that as a baseline. And I would want to know simply the concentration and function of the chemicals of concern in the priority product, the window cleaner that, you know, that triggered the alternative assessment. And also other chemicals, the concentration and function in that product, because when I make this switch to the alternative chemical, how that chemical may or may not react with the other ingredients will be important. I would also like to have technical criteria for the product. What are the must-haves in the priority product in terms of, from the manufacturer's view, in terms of making that product work, because we'll need that later. And the function of the COCs in meeting the product's technical criteria, that gets at the question of whether or not the COCs in the priority product, somebody mentioned before, whether they need to be there. And I'm framing that in terms of the meeting technical criteria for the product. And then for the alternative chemicals, I would want to know the chemical name and synonym, the CAS number, something about the physical and chemical properties, not a lot, but enough that I would be able to make an independent assessment for bioaccumulation or persistence, that sort of thing, emission to air. And I would like to know what COCs the alternative is replacing. I guess that would be obvious, but it would be good to just have that information from the manufacturer's point of view, and also the concentration and function in the product. And then I would actually place high priority on screening, much as the Lowell assessment has incorporated, of screening at that point to make sure that the alternative is not a COC or that it has any of the prioritized hazard traits that we use to develop the COC list. Because for me, there's an opportunity to here to have a regrettable substitution, and I just place very high priority on that. And then I would actually do the assessment of the health and environmental impacts of the alternative. And I thought that we had to use the A through M factors, so I again have, for the health and environmental impact assessment, I would address K, L, F, I, J, and E, in 25253. And in doing that, I would base that on guidance to be developed by the department. And I'm assuming that the prioritized hazard traits are going to incorporate all of the major health and environmental impacts that we want to avoid. So the guidance should be based on that. I would include critical exposure pathways. That's, exposure, environmental exposure as well as human exposure for the alternative. And then lastly, I would do a comparison of the alternative product with the priority product, addressing the remaining factors, C, D, H, G, and A, B, and M. And again, this would be based on criteria and guidance to be developed by the department. That's it.
This is Odette. Let me just make one clarification here. You know, Julia mentioned the term guidance a number of times, and I just want to be clear that while certainly we can, and I'm sure we will be putting out guidance is not something that we can enforce against or that we can mandate.
Right.
Strictly guide. Okay. I just want to make sure you understand.
Yeah, I just think it would be helpful to have, otherwise there will be a lot of inconsistency in terms of how people approach some of this. So, yeah, you can't mandate it, but I assume any guidance you can provide. Are minimum requirements, can you put that in, criteria, minimum criteria?
We can
for
put
meeting
them
in certain...
to the regulations.
Right.
Yes, definitely. It's just anything that is developed outside of the regulations is something that would be guidance as opposed to mandate.
Got it.
Thank you, Julia. Also, I just want to congratulate everybody. You're being very specific. It's very easy to write down comments that you're making. Thank you for the specificity. Continue to think about a window cleaner. Roger.
Thank you, Ken, and thanks to my colleagues for laying this out already. I'll just add a few comments here related to the steps. I was thinking about this in businesses who formulate products like glass cleaners or any other product. Routinely, those companies go through this process, whether it's formalized in the case of very large, sophisticated companies, or if it's just thinking in a smaller company of through this process. Nevertheless, there is this alternatives assessment that's going on within businesses routinely. So I was thinking about how do we, you know, think about these things and how do we frame this. I guess the first part is what George talked about in problem identification. That's the first thing to understand what is the problem that we're dealing with, and to assess the current product. When a product is brought to us, for instance, from a company claiming that they have a quote-unquote safer alternative, we challenge them with some questions to validate that for us. So the first thing is to tell us, assess their own product. So in this particular case, ETSC will need to assess the current product, that is the priority product, and to determine why is it a priority product in the first place. And if it's only a priority product strictly because it contains a priority chemical, and if that's the only focus, then it, maybe fortunately or unfortunately, there may be those who feel that a substitution from one chemical to another is all that's necessary. So assessing the current product. Secondly, know if the priority chemical is present in the product. We would really need to know that. We would ask that question, not only the priority chemical that we had targeted or been concerned about, but also any others that may be listed as well. Then determine if the priority chemical is necessary. That's something we routinely will ask, is the chemical that's in the product, is it really necessary to be there? Is there a way to eliminate it in some other way from being there at all? Then identify potential alternatives. Then pre-screen those to determine if the potential alternative will adversely affect the product function, quality, or performance. That's done early on because it gets to be expensive for companies to invest in these types of alternatives moves, and then later to find out that these particular alternatives don't work. Then pre-screen to determine if the potential alternative is a priority chemical. We also want to know if the potential alternative that they're offering to us, does it have issues that we should be concerned about? If no, then proceed to that next step, the next step. So if it doesn't, then we move to the next step. If it does, then we ask if other viable potential alternatives are available and that do not contain a priority chemical. And if it's yes, then we would prefer that one and so forth. And then we would conduct a alternatives assessment of the potential alternative that passed the pre-screens and determine at least one potential candidate or more, the ones that have the highest probability based on the evaluations that we do on potential alternatives and potential hazards posed by those alternatives, as well as an evaluation of the critical exposure pathways. We would want to know about that as well. And then lastly, comparing, once we get to that point, then compare the current with the potential alternative and report the findings. In this particular case, you would report the findings in all 13 categories. So that's kind of the logic of how we would kind of think through this within a business environment today. Not sure that it necessarily works in a regulatory environment, a government agency environment, but it works for businesses pretty effectively.
Roger, thank you. I want to ask one question in there, and that is the placement of the screen, which you would call availability of the alternative. You've sort of placed that after you've done sort of pre-screening and et cetera. One question that comes up in these things is sometimes firms will screen out a lot of alternatives because they aren't readily available, meaning their distributor doesn't actually have them on as an alternative or something like that. In other words, they use a very narrow definition of availability of alternatives. How wide and where do you really think the question of availability of alternatives is best done in terms of keeping a large enough pool of alternatives available to actually do an analysis?
Yeah, I think that's the question always, because scalability, a couple things. One is the availability of the material. Is it readily available? Is it readily available to us, to the company who, is responsible for making the product? Or is it available on the other side of the planet? Only. Also, scalability is important as well. Is there enough of it being made, even if it were local, is there enough of it being made to be able to accommodate the demand that could be immediately created by moving to an alternative? Those are really important questions that businesses have to deal with, and I think it's difficult. A business has to deal with this kind of individually, because it depends on the size of your business, where you're located, where your manufacturers are located. There's so many variables involved in that decision that it's very difficult, I think, to create, a single kind of statement that would reach across every size business located, no matter where they might be.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Others want to jump in on this, Bear, on the minimum steps or minimum procedures?
Ken, this is Art Mackin on the queue, please.
Art, yes. Anyone else?
Ken, I'd like to get on the queue when, other people have spoken.
Okay.
Dele will...
All right. Why don't we do it, Art, Dele, and then Tim. Art?
Thank you, Ken. Art Fong. I just want to add, some practical experience that we have in terms of the steps that are involved to kind of do a sanity check on what the excellent proposals that have been offered up by the members of the Green Ribbon Science Panel. So, in terms of, let me have a just a caveat in that IBM tend not to make formulated products. So my experience is somewhat limited on this front, but we do work with chemical manufacturers to produce or develop mixtures, so which are very similar to a formulated product, such as a window cleaner. And again, the first thing that, you know, first step that we always look at, and it's something that Julia made an excellent point on, is before we do anything else, we always try to get a very thorough understanding of the product itself. I think some of the factors that Julia mentioned are, you know, content, the function, how the product is used, and, you know, potential exposures. So I think, you know, before we get into things like screening for health hazard concerns or functional equivalent alternatives, it just, again, for what we do, how we approach this, it's, it doesn't make sense unless you have a very thorough understanding of the product itself. And then in terms of, like, some of the steps, you know, initial or primary or preliminary steps on an alternative assessment, and I don't know if I understood Tim's proposals correctly, so maybe I'm just repeating what he's saying, but I think I'm deviating somewhat from what he's proposing, is that I don't see a health hazard as a potential first screen in doing an alternative assessment. How I approach this, or if just some experience, we tend to start with finding a functional or finding viable functional equivalence for you know, the chemical of concern, or you know, redesigning of a product, because unless there are functional equivalents available, then it just doesn't matter if the proposed alternative has the ideal hazard, you know, properties. Sorry for kind of stepping away from a formulated product, but a really classic and good example of that is, you know, about a decade ago, people would started publishing a lot of alternatives that they were proposing for brominated, a particular brominated flame retardant in printed circuit boards. And when they did the health hazard and environmental impact evaluations, some of these, or many of these proposed alternatives were just, you know, were much more favorable in terms of human health impacts or environmental impacts. But unfortunately, when industry took those proposed alternatives and test them in a real product, again, in the printed circuit board, unfortunately, none of those were effective or were actually functional in the printed circuit boards. So you might have, you know, excellent health and environmental impact properties, but not be actually be functional in the product itself. So, you know, how I would start this is to not so much concentrate on the very important human health and environmental aspects, but focus in on developing or identifying viable functional equivalents. And in terms of just one comment about sequential steps, you know, in terms of how to go about doing an alternative assessment, I think that's excellent, but sometimes, unfortunately, that might not be the best business or practical or business approach to how things are done. So, you know, I think Tim and Julia pointed out that sometimes they're just, you know, sometimes there are steps that you can bypass or you can leapfrog just based on professional judgment and experience. So perhaps instead of having a sequence, having a sequential steps that are necessary, perhaps just, you know, listing or highlighting the important steps that a manufacturer or designer should consider. So, Ken, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Art. That was very good. Very good. Deli, do you want to go next?
Yeah, thank you. I'll be brief. I've been thinking about this from the perspective of what might trigger an alternative assessment. And it's, in my experience, it's almost always a very small number of vulnerable populations having experienced something and having the voice to complain. So let's think about the window cleaner. So somebody somewhere is spraying this stuff, and they find out that every time they do it, their asthma kicks in. And maybe they get on a blog, other people complain that they've experienced the same thing, and this comes to the attention of the regulatory agency. So almost immediately, the health impacts become the focus of the alternative assessment. And let's say a company comes back and says, well, I found something that a carrier chemical that will not exacerbate asthma in this particular sub-sample of the population, but the carrier chemical they have can be a greenhouse gas amplifier. And then we have to decide how to put weights on health impacts versus this atmospheric impact. And that will be the function of the experts that use all kinds of life cycle assessment tools. So alternatively, one can imagine that somebody who's knowledgeable in new research comes out about certain chemical that we used to think is in that, but now suddenly has a major environmental impact, and it's found in window cleaners, and that becomes the trigger for alternative assessment. So I really think we can't sequence the procedure. I think I would rather leave that to the discretion of the entity performing the alternative assessment, and almost certainly it will be focused on what experience triggered those kinds of concerns that regulatory agencies were brought in to work on. So I just heard in a couple of previous comments about this issue, and I thought thinking about the initiating action or event might help us think through the better procedure and what the minimum requirements will be to accomplish the goals of the regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dali. Just before I turn to Tim, I'm hearing some things. People seem to feel that steps are important, but maybe the regulation should not specify sequence of steps. Just note that steps are important in some way. And I think there was this idea that one shouldn't, at least in regulations. George and now Dali have both said, be careful of stating weightings or any kind of way in which these things are valued. On the other hand, there's clearly value in trying to identify what to do and to give some guidance, maybe in terms of trade-offs and all others. That's what Tim had suggested earlier, I think. Anyone else not having spoken? Good. Well, let's turn to Tim, and then I think we're going to try to turn to this life cycle question after that. So, Tim, please.
I just wanted to make a couple points and then address your question about availability of alternative. I wanted to follow up on Roger's.
Yes, please.
Just two quick points. I just wanted to express my agreement with both Julie and Art on the importance of initially getting as much complete information and data as you can on the primary product as the starting point for everything else. I agree with that. And I do agree very much with Art's point about functionality being an important screen. I wasn't trying to suggest that it's not. I was just also saying it may be that you're also going to want to screen out alternatives that are clearly significant hazard problems. You know, an extreme example would be suppose the alternative window cleaner is made with dioxin, right? We wouldn't want to waste our time, I think, having somebody do a complete alternatives assessment when it's so obvious that just doesn't make sense. I know that's extreme, but just to drive home the point. On the availability of alternative, I just wanted to stress this notion, at least the view I have of this reg and the way it should be implemented, is that it's a dynamic process. What I mean by that is I'd be careful about using a definition of the availability of an alternative that is too firmly grounded in the present because the regulatory responses that are available to the department include things like implementing a phase-out of a chemical, which, of course, a phase-out could take into account the need for production of an alternative to scale up and so on and so forth. So my suggestion would be, when thinking about the availability of alternative, clearly you want to think about whether there's the capacity to produce the alternative and get it to the manufacturers who would need it. You want to think about that, but I think that that more goes to the regulatory response rather than whether what you've got here is a feasible alternative, and I would focus the question of functionality and feasibility to things like its actual technical performance, so on and so forth. The only other thing I would say, Ken, reacting to what you said, is on the waiting, count me among the people who think that it is the responsibility of the regulations to establish a fairly clear articulation of what the relative importance of criteria are, because this is a societal decision about how we want to trade off hazard with functionality. It's not an individual business decision. That's my perspective. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
So Ken, can I make some response?
Yeah. George, yeah. Please go ahead. Yeah.
Well, just two things. One is, after hearing everybody else's comments, it almost seems to me like everybody's asking for a first step that's essentially a screening level assessment of each of the A through M criteria. Tim's example might be extreme, but if the alternative to ammonia was dioxin, we would reject it out of hand and wouldn't need to do much more. So it does seem to me that if there were some sort of very quick and simple screening level assessment for each of the criteria, it would lead us to the right place as the next step in terms of what to focus on. Then the second point is really this one about waiting. The concern that I have is waiting in the abstract is generally just going to focus on the qualitative aspects of each of the criteria. But these criteria are all very quantitative, such that I wouldn't want a marginal improvement in one of the criteria that we felt had great qualitative weight, but I wouldn't want a marginal improvement in that to drive a significant detriment in something that might have a lesser weight on a qualitative scale, but in terms of its real impact would be much greater. So I think this business of assigning weighting a priori is a much more difficult task than we let on if we simply think that we can evaluate A through M in some sort of qualitative way and be done with it. It's not that simple.
Thank you, George. So it sounds like there's some difference amongst us on the issue, particularly of weighting, although there may be some interesting ways to think about how the regulations might both be helpful but not specific. I don't know, but at least there's a difference there. I did find the... I've lost the point. Nope, I lost it entirely. Okay. What I would like at this point maybe to turn to is the life cycle question, which is really question 1B, where we're being asked to think about the role. I mean, the regulation does require that there be include life cycle tools. And it's kind of a very strange term. Doesn't say life cycle assessment. It says use of life cycle assessment tools. So it brings up a bunch of different ways to think about that. Amongst them, these differences between a full-blown life cycle analysis, or a life cycle thinking approach, or just various tools that can be used in doing a life cycle assessment, and maybe not all tools are used. Our colleagues over in the tiered alternatives section identified maybe some different levels to think about in thinking about life cycle in terms of rigor, in terms of how rigorous you are in doing the life cycle assessment or review, or maybe the factors that you consider, and how many different factors do you actually consider in making sure that you address the 13 points, but there are many ways those 13 points can be considered, or the segments that the life cycle considers. There may be important that for some substances to consider the full life cycle from cradle to cradle. In other cases, you may want to narrow it down and just think about a very narrower view. So they're wrestling with some interesting ideas as well in this area. Our task is really to take a look at sort of what to do about this window cleaner example and sort of think about when you would do, at what level would you think of doing life cycle assessment or life cycle review of some kind, given the A through M, the 13 things that are required by the statute itself. So let's open a discussion on this. What is your thoughts on how to give guidance on what is a life cycle tool and when to use it in regards to the, and when and how to use it in regards to the 13 factors? Not even George is going to save me. Maybe I can try to make it a little easier. What are the upsides and downsides of using specific tools or specific approaches?
On this, Odette, I'll throw in another question to help. If you could talk about whether life cycle tools should be qualitative or quantitative, or does it matter, or does it vary?
Well, I guess this is Dale. I'm not sure we have many alternatives to the life cycle tools. Maybe the first question is, what are the options we have? There are many detractors of LCA, but I don't know how else we can do this kind of thing. And we can certainly include both qualitative and quantitative, but there's no other way to answer the questions that are required for alternative assessments. By definition, LCA tools combine various attributes to generate one manageable index. One of my students and I are working now on using Dempster-Shaver theory to look at how to consider different kinds of evidence. But ultimately, it all leads to the same thing. How do you take different characteristics of the same product and come up with what we need to know? Is it safer or not safer? So
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was going to ask you, when you say by definition, what do you mean? What definition?
The kind of tool that we have and what is generally considered life cycle assessment tools, by definition, they take multiple characteristics and try to come up with a single indicator. So that's what I mean. That's what they're meant to do, and I don't know other ways of doing that outside of the tools that have been developed by the experts of life cycle assessment tools.
But Deli, you could see different approaches to that kind. I mean, one is to do not all of these 13 elements you could do quantitative analysis on, but you certainly could on some. So you could have a numeric-based analysis, which does have numbers. You can reduce things to numbers. In other cases, you really can't, and you might have a qualitative assessment on some of them. And in some cases, you might just identify the impacts and not even really do the analysis and just do what I've seen called a life cycle inventory, just identifying those impacts on things like water use or energy use or climate and implications and all. So you could, there's different levels, and I think the question in some ways is, what kind of tools would you use for what kind of, which of these 13 elements? Should the regulations be specific?
I'd like to get on the queue. This is Tim when there's an opening.
Ken, this is Art. I'd like to get on the queue, please, also.
Okay, we have Tim, then...
Roger, I'd like to get on the queue, please.
Tim, and Art, and then Roger. Okay? Tim, go ahead.
So I would just... I'm not an expert in life cycle assessment. I've read a lot of it, and I know a lot of people who do it. But looking at the statute myself, I think the statute is so lacking in clear direction that you have a great amount of discretion about what to do here. And my sense of it is that trying to engage in too quantitative of a life cycle assessment, kind of like pure kind of technical life cycle assessment or life cycle impact assessment here, trying to graft those methodologies right into the regulations could be very disruptive, mainly because I think it would make the process extremely complicated and resource intensive, probably more so than it would need to be. So when I look at this, I tend to look at it more as an invitation to draw kind of concepts and approaches, what I think some people call life cycle thinking, into it. So, you know, to the extent that there are, so let me give you a specific example. I myself am a little worried about the notion that the regulations would adopt kind of this indicator approach really rigorously from life cycle assessment, given that I think it tends to lose a lot of information that might be relevant to making consider trade-off decisions across different criteria, because it assumes that there's one indicator that might be appropriate for a broad range of environmental impacts, so you lose a lot of information there. So I'm concerned about the technicality of that. In terms of life, so what would it include in my mind? I think one thing that it would include is the idea of thinking about each of the stages of the life cycle, so collecting data that takes into account occupational exposures and upstream production impacts associated with the production of the alternative, so that we're just not looking at the point of use or even just the point of use proposal. So I would say that. So these notions of how and when to construct a system boundary that come out of life cycle analysis, I think would be extremely useful. There are also, I think, some weighting mechanisms that are being developed in life cycle analysis that could be drawn upon, not necessarily directly grafted on upon. So I would keep it at a fairly conceptual level, rather than that we would the regulations would specify, you know, the ISO standard for life cycle impact assessment as what you would have to do.
Thank you, Tim. Art.
Thank you, Ken. Several things I thought about when I was reading through this and then listening to Tim's comment. I think it's good to know that, in fact, there's not, you know, a lot of specificity in terms of exactly how you're supposed to be doing a life cycle assessment in this case. The things, you know, that I thought about was that, you know, there's not going to be a, in terms of quantitative versus qualitative, I don't think there's going to be a one-size-fit-all, determination on this, because I think, at least from our experience, is that LCAs and they tend to be, you know, product class specific or functionality class specific. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind. The other thing about quantitative is that, you know, I'm always concerned that, you know, when you go through this a quantitative LCA, and Tim again highlighted the point that, gosh, does anybody really know what they're doing when it comes to LCAs? So what, you know, one of the concerns that I have, and it's also, you know, I can speak for the semiconductor industries, is that when you come up with a, you know, final number or you know, final impact determinate or whatever, it always gives, for us, it might give a false sense of actual impact. When people see a number, they think that, gosh, it must be, there must be evidence behind it, and I don't think that's always the case. So I think the question that we always ask is that, in terms of, specific tools, is it going to give us reliable and cost-effective information in terms of defining, what the environmental impact of a particular product is? If it's not, then we tend to move away from quantitative LCAs and go towards, either qualitative or life cycle thinking. And in terms of our industry, we actually have spent a fair amount of resources on coming up with simplified ways of doing life cycle assessments. And one of the tools that have been developed, and perhaps I can, afterwards send a link to Kathy so she can forward that to our DTSE colleagues. It's the International Electronics Manufacturing Initiative. It's been working on, and I believe it's the final product should be out this year, something called an Echo Impact Evaluator. So what it does is, instead of, doing a full-blown quantitative LCA, what this particular tool does is that it tries to, based on, previous LCAs that have been done for our types of products and on, what's been published and professional judgment and experience, just identify the key environmental performance indicators and focus in on that, and then do evaluations, and then come up with a qualitative judgment or assessment of, how this particular product actually might impact, what the environmental impact of this particular product is. So I think there are tools that are out there that are being developed, but I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all situation. And again, when it comes to quantitative tools, we want to make sure that it's, in fact, it'll give us it's cost-effective and actually give us reliable information that we can use to go back to our product designers so they can design a better product. Ken, thank you.
Thank you. Roger.
Thank you, Ken, and others, for your input. Great discussion. The bottom line question to me is whether a full-blown LCA actually provides a clear pathway to a safer product or a safer alternative. Because I do not do LCAs, but I've read many, many of them because we require them as part of our relationship with some of our suppliers. And it strikes me that at the end of the day, much of the information that I review doesn't clearly define a safer alternative for us. We have to interpret and make an awful lot of decisions based on unknowns, a whole lot of assumptions in the whole process. So for us, for myself personally, the LCA by itself isn't enough to lead me down the path to make a decision on whether a product is safer or not, or a chemical is necessarily safer. I think it needs to have an alternatives assessment done in addition to the LCA if that's going to be required. And then in reference to your example of the household vinegar and water and the glacial acetic acid and water examples, it points out clearly that often the public, and I don't know who picked these particular examples, but there are certainly portions of the population today that truly believe by putting vinegar in water and using it as a glass cleaner, that truly is a safer alternative, not understanding that vinegar is a chemical, and if in fact you were going to consider using that as an safer alternative, there would need to be a full assessment of the chemicals, and in this particular case, glacial acetic acid, that would need to be made. Same with household ammonia. So I think that points out where the LCA will fall short often. It doesn't do a deep enough dive into the chemical piece of the particular products, at least from my personal perspective.
Let me ask this question. Should mathematical model-based LCAs be preferred, and should the default should they be the default, or basically, I'm hearing Roger be fairly skeptical of the traditional math-based models.
This is George. Can I weigh in?
Sure. Yeah, please.
I think I'm agreeing with everybody in terms of I don't know how one can do this without a life cycle gestalt or life cycle thinking, and in fact. You know, it seems to me that that's really what underpins the A through M criteria, is that they evaluate different aspects of a product's life cycle as well as other characteristics. But the concern that I have with some sort of plug-and-play model that comes out with a single value is that all of the flexibility and all of the transparency that we've been advocating up to now is lost. And, you know, to me, I'd be, you know, much happier if this were left to, some sort of guidance as to a stepwise process, perhaps an iterative process that one went through, you know, where you transparently evaluated each step and each criterion to come up with, you know, some sort of rational narrative as to why an alternative is preferred or not preferred.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this?
Well, this is Deli, and I think as long as the goal is to say this chemical is better than that chemical, we're already in a quantitative mode. And in that decision, we can throw in as many quantitative numbers as we like and qualitative judgment. But I wouldn't want to rule out the tools that we have available, even though they sound like, you know, plug in and play. A lot of thought goes into those tools as well, understanding that some of these numbers, there's a lot of uncertainty associated with them. There's wide variation, and in many cases we don't have equal number of data points for different chemicals to insert. I think the advantage of at least including these quantitative models as important options is that they keep improving over time, and many people in academia, in industry, work on this and use them, and so there's a knowledge base that we shouldn't underestimate in terms of its application to this particular question of whether one chemical is better than the other. We'll never be able to do that just by qualitative judgment. All of these chemicals have numbers associated with them, and to develop a way that we can compare those numbers, I think, is very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Dilly.
Ken, it's Mike Wilson, having joined the conversation.
Okay, Mike, do you know the subject we're on, which is question number 1B, and we're sort of looking at the value of life cycle tools and trying to give clarification on how to think about it. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess it's just a clarification question. If the conversation has been about applying LCA to chemicals irrespective of their use, or is it applying LCA to specific uses of chemicals, for example, in products?
It's sort of been more generic. What would you frame it the way you would want to say it?
I think it's difficult. Maybe this is, you know, just listening to the conversation here briefly, to apply an LCA to a chemical, irrespective of its potential hundred or thousands of uses in commerce.
I see what you're doing. Okay.
It just seems to open up sort of infinite levels of variability to me.
Let me just step in, Mike.
Yeah.
A way to do that would be to focus on this window cleaner as the example. I think that was why the department was presenting that, to help us sort of have a focus in that. If
yeah.
you were to focus on the window cleaner, how would you think about the use of an LCA?
Well, let me step back and just I sort of wanted to ask Roger, in Roger's description of, as I understood it, you know, he was saying that a full-blown LCA doesn't actually lead to, you know, it doesn't give enough information to make an assessment of the product, and that what's missing is an alternatives assessment. And I guess I was interested in hearing from Roger if there was something specifically that he felt would be, you know, greatest utility in that, you know, in the context of what he's doing every day. Is that something you could respond to, Roger?
Roger, do you wish?
Sure. What we would do would be to look at the LCA, and we certainly value them. They're not of no use. They're certainly valuable for us to review. But what's lacking in them is a full understanding of the chemicals that are involved in the product and the impact those chemicals have. So what we do in our particular case, and again, I don't know, I have to qualify this by saying that I don't know if this works within the restraints of regulations and government and agencies, but within the business community, what we would do, we would ask the supplier to provide additional information that wasn't included in the LCA, such things as disclosing the chemicals themselves to us so that we have an understanding of what those, the impacts of those particular chemicals might have within the functional use for which we offer those products. So that's what I'm referring to. It isn't that the LCA isn't valuable. It certainly is. It just falls short to be able to make an informed decision about whether or not one product is preferable over another product when we get into this world of safer.
Roger, this is Corey. Could I ask you a question?
Yes, please go ahead, Corey.
Roger, so what does the LCA that you have experience with inform you on in relationship to the A through M factors? I'm getting the impression that it's giving you a particular piece of information, but I'm not quite sure what that piece of information is, that you're not, so that you have to go back to a supplier, ask for more chemical information.
Well, you know, we're going to look at it in the area of energy conservation, areas of water, area of energy. Those particular areas are pretty strong in LCA, and I think they've been developed over the years to get better and better all the time. But there's really a lack of, again, this is personal opinion, there's a lack of enough you know, robust information about the chemicals themselves in those particular LCAs in many cases.
So if I could rephrase, if you were to look at the particular LCAs that your industry looks at, you're focusing on basically maybe D, water conservation, or E, water impact, and H, energy efficiency, and maybe I, greenhouse gas emissions, and the LCA that you're looking at doesn't hit on those other factors, except for maybe product performance.
Well, I think it hits some of them. It just doesn't do it to the depth that we would need it to make an informed decision in many cases. You look at particular M's kind of breakdown that he provided to us. You know, where I think the LCAs that I've reviewed are relatively strong are in the area of environmental impact, resource impacts, technical performance piece, certainly the cost piece. But where I think it lacks is in that very first one, the human health and public safety portion, at least from my viewpoint.
Okay.
And could I get on the queue for the question about math when you have a chance? Tim?
Yes. I think we're also moving toward a break here, so why don't we have Tim be our last speaker on this, unless there's someone with an urgent comment. So, Tim, why don't you go ahead?
So I was just going to say my answer to that question really depends on what the tool is being used for and what kind of math you're talking about. So I want to make a distinction, and this goes to that chart that I think we're going to talk about later today. But I distinguish most life cycle analysis and impact analysis, as Roger does, from the full alternatives analysis, because I think most of the life cycle stuff I've seen generates information about impact, and where the math seems to come in is through, you know, various fairly technical mathematical manipulation to take lots and lots of data and generate these kind of indicator, either single points or distributions of points for these indicators. And so I think of that as the part of the mathematical tool, and I tend to think that that's probably unnecessary, and I also fear it loses some of the important information that you would want to have for making judgments about human health impacts, so on and so forth, that it doesn't have to be quite that, you know, homogenized and manipulated to come out with one indicator. So that's one kind of math that I think about. But on the other end of it, there's this question about evaluating, making the actual judgment, now that you have the data about how the various alternatives perform across your different criteria. Now, how do you make the judgment about which one is, however you define it, the safer alternative? And for that one, I think that some mathematical tools may be helpful, not in terms of coming out with an answer, right? Because I appreciate George's point, and I agree with him. These mathematical models shouldn't be used to come out with, like, the answer, which is a black box answer, and we all just accept, but rather should present results that then can be looked at and interpreted. But what those results would be is they would lay out for you kind of a taking into account how important you think a particular criteria is and how well a particular alternative did on that criteria, comparing them across all the criteria, kind of a breakdown of kind of a ranking or an ordering of them, but also both through graphic presentation and also through interpretation of the results, an understanding of why a particular alternative did better or didn't do better, which then challenges the person who prepared the alternative analysis as well as the regulator and folks generally to kind of really face what are the trade-offs that they're making and why. So I think actually that's an instance in which the use of the mathematical tool can actually enhance transparency and the ability of people to kind of look at complicated decisions with incommensurables and kind of get an understanding of why a particular result occurred and where they might make changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. I would just make a comment before the break here just to sort of say that, you know, I do appreciate the work that's gone on in developing life cycle assessment as a process, as a tool, and some of the great work that's gone on in trying to quantify it around those things that can be quantified, energy being an excellent example. And I do think that's good. I see the innovation in the law, in the statute, as A, saying that these alternative assessments must consider a life cycle, which is going to be is certainly a big step forward in thinking about alternative of the way in which a government sort of defines what an alternative assessment is. So I think that's very positive. I do get worried, though, beyond that, who's going to do these alternative assessments? to the degree that some very sophisticated firms, multinational firms, are going to be called upon to do these, I think, you know, they're going to be able to do quite a good job, and there'll be a range of possible ways that they could levels of sophistication of their life cycle tool use. But there's also going to be a lot of mid-range folks and a lot of smaller firms that are selling products in California. And at a certain level, tying up people in a lot of life cycle assessment kind of processes, instead of getting at really the way to move forward on what is a safer alternative, makes me concerned. So I like the idea and really encourage that we have a range of options, but that there be a kind of a default that life cycle thinking or a life cycle checklist or a life cycle inventory of some kind is sort of the bottom line, and that as the degree of concern or issue about the significance of the impacts, that then one would build a more rigorous life cycle assessment obligation. I would suggest at this point that we sort of take a break and come back, and if there's more to say on this subject, we could, but we also need to look at this diagram some and also move on to these other questions. So my suggestion is, folks, that we take something like a 5-minute or less break at this point.
Yeah.
So we stand in recess for about 4 or 5 minutes.
Thanks.
Are most people back?
Yes.
Okay. I assume we're back, so let us return here. I was picking up there a little bit of conversation about the LCA. Did Julia want to say something to this? I want to try to wrap this part of the discussion up, but Julia, you didn't speak, so if you'd like to say something there, it would be important.
I was just trying to understand the difference between, in our conversation, between a formal LCA, which I'm not that familiar with personally, and how that differs from those alphabets, and I don't have them in front of me, but that's a part of the, you know, the mandate that deals with energy, water use, you know, that are just very LCA-focused. You know, it sounds like we have to use a formal LCA tool, and my understanding, limited though it is that we could address those LCA components that are specified in that section of the code without using a tool. I mean, is that possible? In other words, can you qualitatively, if possible, talk about a comparison between the energy requirements, water usage, those things, between the priority product and the alternative product, because I think the comparison between those things is what is important. I don't know if that's possible, but I'm just asking the question whether or not we have to have one of these formal, very mathematical, tools or whatever to do this assessment.
Okay, I'm going to be a little careful with this, unless there's a point, is to say that the question is going to lead us into a long discussion about what an LCA can and can't do, and I'm not sure that that's going to help us that much. Is there a concern that you have that you're trying to say, I don't want to see this happen, or something like that?
Well, I just was, it sounded like we were required in some way to use an LCA tool, as opposed to making a qualitative assessment of energy requirements and that sort of thing. That's all.
This is Odette. Let me address it really quickly. The statute uses the term LCA tool. It does not define it. I don't necessarily interpret the statute requiring that the LCA tool be a mathematical model, and that's why we threw out the question at the beginning and then later on in terms of the your advice in terms of whether these tools should be qualitative versus quantitative. So, no, I do not think that we are forced to use solely mathematical models.
Okay. So I would just weigh in on the qualitative assessment of the LCA type factors in the code.
Good.
And
okay.
Ken, can I just pick up on that briefly? This is Mike.
Okay, I do not want to get into what an LCA can and can't do, though, because that will get us all into a wonderfully rich discussion and not be helpful. So be clear, and it is better that you state your opinion.
I guess in looking, and it's a sort of picking up from Julia's point from our last call, that there are four parts of the A through M that are specifically C, D, G, and H that lend themselves specifically to LCA tools, you know, sort of with regard to where the LCA technology is right now. And as Roger said, the, you know, E, F, I, K, L, and J, which are hazard traits, aren't part of, you know, aren't part of LCA tools right now. And so I'm just, I guess, for point of clarification as we're going into the next discussion, I'm getting confused in thinking about how we apply LCA as that, you know, in its current state of the technology to all of the factors A through M, and that maybe we should be talking about applying LCA to C, D, G, and H, and alternatives assessment to the other ones I listed.
Well, you give me a very good place to turn to this question of can you group these 13 elements in some ways and treat them differently, which is part of 1C, and maybe we could pick up your point. I think your point is that the first few elements there are quite often used in LCAs and others of these aren't. Are there other ways we can think about grouping these 13 elements? Department suggests a possible step one, step two, step three, as an example, with a window cleaner, which would look at the health and environmental factors first, then do an LCA or a life cycle tool-based assessment on the alternatives, and then to look at performance and cost factors. We picked up a little bit of this in the earlier hour, but does anyone want to speak directly to that way of thinking about grouping these 13? Tim provided us a way of earlier in your homework, a classification that had about five different ways of grouping these things. So along the line, maybe Tim should explain his thinking on that.
Well, Ken, just if I can make a clarification as a factual matter, two things about LCA, and I know you don't want to get into this, but we're kind of like branching off of an assumption that I think is inaccurate, which is I think modern LCA techniques do include human health exposures, environmental exposure, basically all the factors that are in A through M. There are examples of life cycle impact analysis today that has indicators for those, it deals with those. Not everyone does it. Not each, you know, it depends on what somebody's using the life cycle assessment for. But, like, you know, there's some really, it's Julie's work on lead solder and on cathode ray tubes and TV displays and stuff like that is an example of really sophisticated LCA that looks at human health impacts as well as other impacts, cost, all that stuff. So, it actually does, my understanding, of course, I don't know them, but my understanding, I've read a bunch of them that do that. And I think the other distinction that has to be made is that I think a lot of LCA stops at kind of the data collection and presenting kind of a matrix that shows you how the different alternative processes or products do within each criteria. There's less LCA that goes that next step that evaluates it and then identifies which is best or not best in a product context. And the stuff I've seen that does that actually imports from outside the LCA area other tools that are typically used in business for production and management decision-making about, you know, process decisions and so on and so forth. So it's not quite as cut and cut out like that, that one would say we could use LCA for these factors. LCA isn't available for the other ones, so we'll develop some other methodology. My view of it is that LCA, technically done, mathematically done, isn't really appropriate in our regulatory context, but that we can learn from it. And maybe do simplified or qualitative approaches to that, but I don't see that we should treat different factors separately. Sorry about that digression. But, on the chart, I'm in an uncomfortable position in that I've lost my internet access, so I'm doing the chart by memory, but all I basically did in that chart was take those factors and then group them into broader criteria of human health and function, performance, and so on and so forth. And there's not much more to it than that. I just tried to group things that were generally the same into higher-level categories.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that clarification. That's helpful. Well, speaking to this grouping question, though, should these elements be considered in different groupings? Should there be a sequence to them? Any comments on this?
This is Julia. I like the sequence that's laid out in 1C. I also had taken A through M and clustered them into what I called LCA, which was C, D, G, and H, and health and environmental impacts, which were the majority, E, F, I, J, K, and L, and then what I call technical criteria for the comparison of the product and the alternative would be A and B and M, because those don't fall into either LCA or, you know, environmental, the environmental and health assessments. And I like that as, I think, you know, if you're a person who has a product and looking for an alternative, as some people have said before, you would probably want to know if the alternative worked before you, you know, that's going to be a major criterion. It has to actually, you know, work in the product because you want a product that you can market. So it is iterative in that way, that you're not going to go down a pathway just looking at impacts without knowing that you have a chemical that can be substituted, if that's what you're doing, into the for the chemical of concern. But I think this addresses the concerns that I would have in terms of being able to come up with a safer product, which is the goal.
Any other comments on this? We actually addressed some of this in the earlier hour, where you may remember there was this discussion about should the health and environmental impacts be first, or should the performance characteristics be up front? And there was this kind of sense that was too simplistic a way to look at it, that you really wanted to have the do some pre-screening on it, the performance characteristics, before you got to the health and environmental factors, but you also had to be willing to knock out things even as they were a COC or as people mentioned. But I think there's also this sort of sense that one wants to think that this is an iterative process, and that the actual doing of an alternative assessment shouldn't be seen as a set of lockstep screens that one goes through and cannot go back once one has gotten through one thing. I mean, that would rigidify the alternative assessment into a way that I think makes it very formalistic and deprives it of its potential innovative characteristic of really searching out the safer alternatives.
Ken, this is Tim, and I don't want to, like, monopolize it, so I have something to say, but just put me on the queue.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you for that respect. Anyone else have a comment here?
This is George. Just to, thank you for bringing that up, I think that the main thing is this be an iterative process with flexibility. I continue to have problems taking either the abstract or just one example and trying to rigorously state what should be first and foremost in an assessment. I think it's really going to depend on the individual situation And I think that one would, at the end of this, you know, come to conclusions that may in fact need to be cause the initial steps to be revisited. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, things like product performance and useful life, and it'd be easier if this was our favorite brake pad example. But, you know, let's say just for argument's sake that there were substantial enough difference in window cleaner performance that a window needed to be cleaned twice as often with an alternative that was otherwise the preferred option, you know, leading to a doubling in the risk of death or injury from falling from scaffolds. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of things that we need the flexibility in an assessment to develop.
In my mind, there's a difference between how the alternatives assessment is presented to the department in the sense of a written document of some kind, which might have a series of steps that shows how the alternatives assessment was the way to understand how the firm got to the conclusion that it did, but that is different from the actual process by which the firm actually did the work, which might have gone back and forth several different times in trying to adjust different factors and parameters in order to come up with those alternatives that made the most sense and were the most safe, and et cetera. So I think one doesn't want to assume that just the way it is presented is the way it should be done.
I think that's them. This is Mike, Ken. If I could jump in here,
yeah.
I think that's exactly right. That that what's useful here on these three steps is. Hold on one sec. Is a way of looking at the three different elements of this process, but that they are doesn't make sense, I think, for them to be sequential. But it's sort of locking as you move forward from one to three. I think it makes sense that this is a useful approach, and I could sort of visualize. I think as you're saying, Ken, that each of the steps would have some sort of outcome, and in the end, a decision would have to be made on whether you were shifting risks from a health problem to a safety hazard, as George pointed out, or an ergonomic problem. But it's not necessarily a stepwise process, but one that produces a set of answers from each of these three steps, from which a decision would then have to be made.
Tim, did you want to maybe come in at this point?
Sure. I just wanted to say, you really got me thinking. This is an add-on. You really got me thinking with your last point about, you know, you could do an analysis whichever way fits your kind of a way of thinking about your corporate structure, your expertise, so on and so forth. But then, you know, it would have to you'd have to present it to the department in a kind of consistent way. And I agree with that. I think that's right. And what, you know, one way you could think about the alternative assessment process in the regulation is not so much as a process, but a method for justifying a particular ordering that the company is presenting to the department. Essentially, the department would be saying, if you want to order your alternative or say this alternative is better than that one, you have to justify it using these factors or these points and so on and so forth. So I think that's a nice way to think about it. And so then stepping back to the question, okay, so how should something be justified under the regulations, looking at these steps, I have two points to make about them. First, I'm very uncomfortable with the way these steps are laid out for window cleaners or for anything else. And the primary thing I've expressed before was this notion that it doesn't allow compensating or trading off between these things. The other thing I'm a lot uncomfortable about, and I think this came through in Julia's points as well, was this notion that life cycle means particular criteria as opposed to how you think about each criteria. So, for example, when I think about health and environmental factors, I think about them across the life cycle, not, you know, in the point of use. So I think what hopefully, perhaps what step two here is getting at is not so much the life cycle impact as much as criteria that we tend to think of as being focused on in life cycle analysis, like energy, like natural resource use, like so on and so forth. I don't know. But if what step two is referring to are, is something different, then I'm not sure exactly how those two fit together. And I would much rather, if I was looking at steps, say, when you look at health hazards, you think about all the health hazards along the life cycle of the product. When you look at environmental impacts, same thing with climate change or, greenhouse gas, ozone depletion, the whole thing. And the last point I just wanted to make is, you know, it's like we don't really need to operate in a vacuum in terms of decision methods, because what we're really talking about here are kind of, you know, basic decision frameworks. And this, I think, would probably be called what's known as a lexicographic type decision, where you pick out a particular criteria that you think is of most importance to you. You pick the one that meets that, or the top three that meet that. You screen out all the others, and now you compare the remaining ones on the next most important factor. And that's a fairly standard decision-making approach, and it's got its pros and its cons, and there's a fairly rich literature in decision analysis that kind of identifies what those pros and cons are. We've hit them, I think, in a fairly ad hoc way in our conversations, but I think it would be useful when the department and when we are thinking about different ways to set up the alternatives analysis that we're doing it with a mindset that says, okay, so this is a particular kind of decision framework, and here's the plus and here are the minuses of it, and then make a decision. I think that would be a more systematic way of thinking about this, and maybe others won't, but I'd be very happy to. I've got some materials that kind of lay out in a fairly straightforward fashion what these decision kind of frameworks are, like we're talking about, and talked a little bit about, you know, how they compare to one another and where they might be most appropriate, different kinds of things. I'd be happy to kind of pass that stuff around if you think it's useful.
Tim, this is Odette. I think it would be useful. Now, these would be case by case, though, right? I mean, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
You mean in terms of how something might fit into an alternatives analysis, like in the regs?
Yeah, well, and in terms of what you were just talking about, in terms of the process for identifying what factors are most important.
It could be, it could be either way you would want to, one would want to set it up. So, for example, one could say we're going to use a lexicographic decision approach, which means you identify the most important, then the second most, and the third, and you sequentially screen things out, which is, I think, what this example here is. And there's different variations on that, but, you know, they have particular names for these different variations. The materials that I have would be kind of generic in the sense that they wouldn't be saying, here's what should be most important to you. They're not even necessarily in the environmental context. They're in the context of what are different ways to make decisions when you're choosing across alternatives. And they're not mathematical or anything like that. They're just kind of like the basic, you know, it's like,
right.
My daughter had to choose what college to go to. How do we decide that? Well, we looked at, she identified five factors that were really important to her, and she kind of like rated each school on all those five factors, and she kind of looked at it in a gestalt way and said, on balance, here's which one I think does the best across all five. That's one kind of decision making. She could have instead said, as I might have liked, cost is the most important factor. Best one in cost, right? And that's what I'm going to choose. Or she could have said, I'm going to take the top three on cost, then I'm going to run them through a screen on, you know, intellectual rigor, then I'm going to run them through, you know, party life or whatever. And those are fairly standard decision-making approaches, and the materials that I would be able to kind of get together for you would be to kind of a systematic identification of here's your four or five kind of major different ways that you can make a decision when you're, you know, picking between alternatives. But then if, you know, you're interested in one, the actually kind of customizing that either to an individual case or to a regulatory program, that's something that you'd have to, these materials wouldn't necessarily help you with that. what they would help you with would be saying, here's the pros and cons of using electrographic versus kind of a multi-criteria approach to it. You know, you're going to, like I said, I'm obviously not a big fan of lexicographic approaches because I'm more of a Gestalt type person. So that's what that stuff would do.
And I think for us, I understand the concept. I think for us the challenge is, you know, what is the rationale and criteria for determining which factors are more important? I think that's the real challenge here.
Okay.
If we were to take that approach.
Yeah, well, that's going to come up in any approach you take, honestly, though. It's just going to come up in a different way. You're not going to be able to get away from that one.
Okay. I think I would agree with Tim's last point there. I don't think that's going to answer that question. The tools that Tim's speaking of, I think, are tools that can assist but not answer that.
But advice on that.
The value question, yeah.
Valuable.
So here's my dilemma at the moment. We have, if we reserve 5 minutes at the end, we have about 20 minutes left. I have two questions to get to, actually they're relatively straightforward questions, but I want to hit both of them because I know the department will provide much guilt upon me if I don't get to the last one. As you may have already heard, they've snipped at me for it. But we have one question which has to do with the kind of data models, and I think the core issue here to call our attention to is, should the department in its regulation permit the use of what might be called proprietary model tools or proprietary, sometimes called black box tools or something like that, where transparency is not apparent? That we have many firms out there providing very useful decision-making frameworks for chemical comparisons, but the actual protocols are not publicly available. So that is one, and the second one really has to do with time frame. How long should the department assume that an alternative assessment take in order to do it? Is there a way to give some kind of framework? Is this something that should be done in a month? Is it several months? What about people who want to do several years? Can I ask people to comment on either or both of these?
Okay, this Odette, while you're thinking, I'll say something really quickly on the latter question in terms of the time frame. The big reason we're asking this is there's a number of people who really want us to, you know, hold manufacturers' feet to the fire, make sure they give them to us in a relatively prompt manner. I think there's probably general agreement that there's no one-size-fits-all answer to the time frame. But how would we, given that we lack experience in doing alternatives assessments, go about, for even on a case-by-case basis, determining what is a reasonable time frame for completing an AA?
This is George. Can I take
George
a step? So, you know, this ends up being a question of framing the magnitude of the work more than anything else in my mind. And it seems like, you know, we're still on a, you know, trying to evaluate a manageable number of chemicals and a manageable number of product sets. And I almost think that, you know, the right thing to do would be to, you know, set some sort of time frame based on the complexity of the problem that would have to be worked out on a case-by-case basis between DTSC and whoever was doing the assessment. I mean, this window cleaner one seems very straightforward, and I could easily see having a very short time frame on it. And I think most things that we're going to be contemplating, may in fact be more complex than this.
So maybe the way you might do that is when the department announced a so-called product of concern or whatever, and required alternatives assessments to be done, it would indicate the level. The time frame that it would expect, dependent on how much complexity they think that the actual activity would take. Is that your
mm-hmm.
idea?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Others?
Candace, it's Art. May I get on the queue, please?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
A comment about the black box approach. I don't see how that would be add any or contribute to the transparency that we're after in this, you know, particular green chemistry initiative. I mean, I can certainly, and we industry certainly use, you know, these so-called black box approaches for, you know, internal business and product design decisions, and I think they're great. But I, you know, if in fact those approaches are allow under this particular set of regulations, is it possible then to, like, you know, set up something like what the EPA has in terms of CBIs, and that information, or, you know, those black box approaches, in fact, would be accessible to DTSC, so they can, you know, be kind of like the public owners of what was done. So I think that again, I think, you know, black box approaches do not add transparency to what we're trying to do. They're excellent. Some of them are excellent for, you know, making internal business and product design decisions. But if they're going to be used, I think they should, DTSC should have access to, you know, what was done and how it was done. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then, Odette, our challenge here is that certainly it could be made available to DTSC, and there's, you know, the trade secret provisions of the statute. But the statute also says that to the extent possible, that these tools should be transparent in terms of use. And so we're not sure how that meshes with these black boxes or proprietary tools. On the other hand, we recognize that for certain types of things, it may be that the only tools available currently are proprietary. So that's kind of the dilemma.
This is thanks, Ken. This is Mike.
Mike, please.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess you know, I'm hearing the challenge that Odette's describing. I would, you know, agree with Art, but a little more strongly that a transparent black box is obviously an oxymoron. You know, it's like it's like a jumbo shrimp. And it just seems to me that one of the values of the process of implementing this, you know, putting this regulation into place, will be a transparent process from which the businesses in California and agencies will begin to a continual learning process, and that the process of alternatives analysis and the use of LCA tools and so forth will move forward if that process is transparent, and the technology will improve, the decision making will improve, the efficiency will improve, but all of that will be stymied if we allow the use of non-transparent methods, black box approaches. That's sort of one issue. And, of course, the other issue is that it's incumbent upon the department, you know, in acting on the, you know, to making a decision about alternatives, to the extent to which the department is charged with doing that, you know, black box approaches are going to stand in the way of the department's obligation there. I don't really see any way to allow those kinds of tools to be brought into this public arena, as much as they're useful, as Art says, you know, within private company decision making.
So in the situation where the only currently available tool for a given factor is proprietary, would you then be recommending that we not use that tool and instead we use a less rigorous qualitative type of analysis?
If I could answer that, Ken, I would, actually. I would step back from the proprietary tool, and if what we have is more crude, the value of that of the coarser model is that it would be transparent. Everyone would understand what the metrics are, and we would understand the limitations of that tool, and that would allow us to learn and begin to make improvements on that tool in a transparent way. Yeah.
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue, Ken.
Okay. Tim, if you could keep it kind of short, though.
Very short.
Yep.
Two things. I just had a question. Part of my comment is that I'm curious, like, what tools are you talking about? Like, because it strikes me that there's plenty of tools out there that would enable the department to develop a pretty rigorous, transparent alternatives assessment methodology. So I'm wondering, what are the factors that you're worried about, and are there specific tools that you think some folks have that that there is no replacement for?
This is Corey. Well, we've heard from the group here that there are some of these factors that there are no tools for. So if a company comes up with this grandiose tool and has it peer reviewed for, like, a very rigorous tool for evaluating human health, let's say, and it has it peer reviewed, but you don't know what that those calculations are in that black box, but it spits out consistent answers. It's used by a number of people that use maybe throughout, you know, not in this country, in other states or whatever. It seems to be well accepted. Would you accept that proprietary model, even though it's, you don't know exactly what's in that black box?
Well, Tim, if I can, push you to Tim's question, which is, are there actual examples? Is this a story, or is there real examples where there's only proprietary tools?
Well, I'm kind of thinking, I guess, anecdotally, that most of the greenhouse gas tools are proprietary.
Okay. All right. All right.
Well,
Tim, do you want to
be honest with you, I think there's pretty standard. It depends on what it is you're looking for. So if we're adopting, but wait, let me back up. The first answer is, I cannot think of any circumstances under which a regulatory program like this could legitimately allow people to use a black box methodology for regulatory purposes, even if it's been peer reviewed by folks within an industry. I mean, honestly, I don't even see how that would be legal, let alone why. Having said that, like, take the example of greenhouse gases. It really depends on, you know, what it is you adopt for life cycle approaches. So if you're using life cycle thinking, it'd be fairly, I think it's fairly easy, and maybe I'm overstating it a bit, but figuring out what the life cycle what the greenhouse gas impacts of a particular chemical are, I just don't see that, number one, as being kind of like so central to the alternatives analysis itself that you would want such tremendous rigor and so on and so forth. But number two, I think, you know, there's lots of mechanisms that folks use in publicly available life cycle analyses for products where they calculate greenhouse gas impacts. So I guess I'm not empirically convinced that the assumption that's being presented as the problem is actually a problem.
Right.
So that's why I don't see a justification for it.
Okay.
Anyone else on this or the time frame question?
Quickly, it's Mike. Again, I don't really see how an alternatives analysis could be considered or could be judged, you know, on how rigorous and consistent it is if it's not transparent.
Thank you. Anyone else want to jump in on this?
Ken, this is Roger.
Please, go ahead, Roger.
We could borrow some help from financial pieces of businesses that have to disclose financial information. Give you an example. You may have to disclose your revenue, but you don't have to disclose your entire list of customers, or what they're buying, or how much of it they're buying, or where they're, where the sale comes from. So I think there are ways to ask for this information to get very specific things without digging so deep that you get into the begin to mess with the business relationships that are in place. So maybe that's one place we could look, begin to look at what's being done in those particular areas.
Anyone else on this or time frame? What? How long? George has given us a sort of a criteria for thinking about it, that this be specified at the time that the department calls for alternative assessments. Is there any other way to think about the time frame?
I worry. This is Mike, Ken. I worry about setting time frames for individual products and that for individual alternatives analyses, and that. What that does is opens up the possibility of questioning the a time frame for every single product, because it seems to me that even in the case of the window cleaner, there's going to be a whole set of complicated issues that that might really be difficult for companies to grapple with. And so, and it's like anything else, the tendency is going to be to put that off as long as the product can continue to be sold, and to forestall the work that needs to be done and the costs potentially in conducting the alternatives analysis and so forth. That so I think it's very important that the that there be very clear deadlines and that they not be product specific.
And how would there be any variation in your model of would there be just one generic deadline, or would there be different deadlines? And if so, what would the criteria be if it wasn't sort of product specific?
Yeah, your question is what would the criteria be for a sort of a range of deadlines, or two or three deadlines, for example.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly.
What, yeah. I guess that's I don't have a good answer for that. Good a thought on that.
Okay.
Unless it's I could see how there may be initial data that are submitted by a specific deadline, and a final decision made by a subsequent deadline as a possibility. But I definitely want to move away from the idea of making every deadline adjustable for every single product and every alternatives analysis.
Okay, good. Mistake. Good. Okay, we're wrapping up here. Are there, just thinking over the whole 2 days that we've had of conversation, is there any sort of pressing point that anyone needs to make, something that's really important to them? Wow. All right. Very good. So we are wrapping up of our second day of discussion, and frankly, I have to again thank you. I think this one was even more concrete and more specific, and I hope equally more helpful to the department in moving forward here. To the degree, again, if this has stimulated you to want to write something down and send it in, the department, of course, would be very pleased to have documentation or some idea or other issues, something you don't feel was clarified or something like that. Please feel free to do that. It'd be nice if you could do that in the next week or so, because the department's going to be trying to wrap up these and put together their reports on these. But other than that, I think that's going to conclude our work, and I'm going to turn this over, I believe, to Odette and Kathy to kind of close out our day.
Thank you, Ken. And I do want to underscore that this has been very helpful. A lot of good new ideas and interaction. I do want to tell you it's helpful and specific because this has been based upon our experience last go-around. It really would be helpful for us if you could take the time to give us a very brief written recommendations preferably by a week from this Friday, which I think would be the 17th. I can tell you that will make it much easier for us to ensure that we capture your perspectives and your recommendations when we develop the what we call the concept options, which we'll be putting forward for discussion when the full draft meets in July. So to the extent you can find time to do that, we would really appreciate it. And we will be preparing, like we did last time, you know, what we call the report out from what we heard. Staff have been vigorously taking notes, and we will be sending that to you probably next week sometime and asking you to take a look at it and make sure that we have completely and accurately captured your thoughts on it. And so we'll be letting you know next week, probably towards the end, when you'll be getting that. So, again, thank you so much for your time and efforts and your thoughtfulness. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.